Yes.
Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday, November the 22nd, 2021, and I have begun to associate Mondays with discussions with Jimmy Sexton of the Esquire Group about Charles Adams' great book, Good and Evil, Taxes and Civilization. And we're continuing every Monday until we exhaust all these lessons. And then we're going to go back to the beginning and talk about them all from a different angle. But here we go. Today is talking about lesson five. So how are you today, Jimmy? And where are you today?
I am fantastic. I am in beautiful Dubai at the moment. We have perfect equivalent of Southern California weather. And appropriately, we have no taxes, which makes every day a little bit brighter.
That's fantastic. So when you talk about good and evil, taxes and civilization, you are truly from the outside looking in.
I am. I mean, look, I mean, Dubai, I think, is very equitable in the way it's done, right? Everything is indirect taxes in the form of government fees that everybody has to pay. The more services you use, the more you consume. We have a value-added tax, the more you pay. And I think that's a pretty good system.
Well, it's working so far, and it's working, I suppose, to some extent, because as far as I know, Dubai, or the UAE, I guess, hasn't been around long enough to get into any real crisis mode, right? No.
It's been 50 years. As a matter of fact, this year is its 50th anniversary of the UAE.
Oh, my God, that's unbelievable. So you mean I'm older than the UAE?
I guess so.
I like that. There are countries that are younger than I am. Well, that's pretty awesome. Well, here we go. Let's begin today with reading the lesson, and then we'll talk about how that might apply to today's world.
For sure.
Here it is, lesson five. When wars or other great emergencies demand great revenues, then all citizens should be taxed according to what they are worth by equitable principles, not odious arbitrariness. Interesting. Let's read that again. When wars or other great emergencies demand great revenues, then all citizens should be taxed according to what they are worth by equitable principles, not odious arbitrariness. Okay.
Well, I mean, immediately what comes to mind is the billionaire tax.
Yeah.
I mean, that certainly doesn't apply to all citizens equitably.
Well, you know, I mean, obviously I agree with you, but there are some people who would say, well, of course it's equitable because they have more money, therefore they should pay more. How would you respond to that?
Well, I would say it's absolutely not fair, right? I mean, I think there was an article, I think it came out today in The Economist that was talking about the fact that governments are just going to keep getting bigger. And it was actually talking about what I'm always bitching about on LinkedIn, which is, you know, all of these tax revenue shortfalls, or let's call them budget shortfalls. The reason that they don't have enough revenue has nothing to do with nobody paying their fair share. It's very simple government overspending.
Well, it certainly is that, but, you know, I wonder, I mean, doesn't the principle here say that, all right, so if you're going to have a wealth tax, then it should apply to everybody?
Well, I think it should. I mean, in order to be able to make it equitable, I mean, look, I mean, arguably, you know, Switzerland has a very successful wealth tax. I mean, I think, as a matter of fact, they have probably the most successful wealth tax that I'm familiar with. It's a very, very small percentage, but it applies to everybody as far as I know. And I think that's pretty fair.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's the issue of the fairness of the tax, and there's the issue of the fairness of the application. And, you know, it seems to me that for, you know, the Democrats to identify 700 people who they want to tax, Regardless of what the tax is, doesn't seem to me to be a tax that's very fair in its application.
No, I mean, it's discriminatory.
It is discriminatory. I would agree with you on that. Well, you know, so he talks about wars. He talks about other great emergencies. You know, one of the things that has been clear to me is the effect of wars on taxation and finance. I mean, if we look at the situation in the United States, I think that a lot of it probably can be traced right back to the Bretton Woods Agreement in the 1940s that sort of anointed the United States dollar as the standard world reserve currency. And, you know, we saw the effect of the war on the British, you know, which was essentially, I think, sort of transferring the baton of a dominant world currency from the pound to the dollar at that point, I think, right? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
And, you know, we can see how the U.S. has managed to leverage that. And, you know, I think that to a very large extent, the retention of the citizenship-based taxation regime is to some extent underpinned by the fact of the dollar being the reserve currency. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very, very well could be. You know, it's funny when you talk about the citizenship-based taxation, I've never thought of making a sort of a graphic out of it. But when I picture the citizenship-based taxation, in the way I describe it to clients is like each U.S. citizen is like a little savings account, right? It's like I see the United States with all these, you know, access to all these little savings accounts, everybody all over, where they're not only getting a piece of their income throughout their lives, but when they drop dead, you know, maybe they get some estate tax and they continue to get it forever and ever.
Maybe there should be a requirement for them to report all those accounts. I mean, you know, they're busy, you know, requiring individuals to report accounts. Maybe the government should, you know, publish a list of all the U.S. citizens and their bank accounts, you know, that they're busy, you know, breaching into. I don't know.
No, I mean, look, in all honesty, I mean, you start seeing, and I mean, now you see it at the corporate level, right? You have this country by country reporting. You know, now there's talk within the EU of making, corporate finances public, that they're going to be publicly published, you know, the multinationals' financial results. And I don't think that we're so far off that at some point they're just going to make all of this stuff public.
You're right. And, you know, we've talked about this before, but, you know, at a bare minimum, what the Pandora Papers thing is clearly about is, you know, a sense that there should be no financial privacy whatsoever. Everybody ought to be able to look up exactly what everybody else has, right?
Well, I mean, that's absolute. Well, I mean, and that's the thing that I think that's so dangerous about the Pandora Papers, right? Because what the argument with the Pandora Papers is essentially, if you're wealthy, you should have no financial privacy, right? That all needs to be disclosed. And so the vast majority of people are for this because they've been sold this idea that the wealthy are not paying their fair share, and therefore they shouldn't have any financial privacy or anything else. And governments will use this broad public support in order to continue to implement transparency laws, and then they're going to make them applicable to more and more people, where pretty soon the average citizen won't have any financial privacy. And then they're going to sit there and go, what in the hell did we do? And what they did was support nonsense like the Pandora Papers, which essentially did nothing more than prove that most offshore activity is completely legal. I mean, there's almost no illicit activity in it, right?
Or at least they didn't bother to, you know, to go further at all. I mean, it was just sort of a, you know, a gossipy kind of, you know, this person is that, you know, I mean, it was absolutely crazy. I mean, it's though at the moment, you know, there's two kinds of people in the world, those who don't need financial privacy because they have nothing, and those who can't have it because they do have something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it creates classes. And the thing that I think is so I don't even want to call it funny, but, you know, that I thought was so interesting about the Pandora Papers. I mean, two of the people that they were, you know, shaming most in terms of headlines in a lot of the media coverage of the Pandora Papers was one of the sheikhs here in the UAE and the King of Jordan, neither of which legally have to pay any income tax in the countries where they're from. So what are they doing? What are they evading? They don't even have a fair share to pay.
Well, but their basic crime is that they're just not, you know, being transparent about what they have. I mean, basically the motto of 2021 and onward is report early, report often, report everything, and make sure you let the press keep a record of what you report, right?
I mean, you might as well file your taxes with the New York Times, right? I mean, forget about the IRS.
Well, exactly. And let the New York Times decide who should be audited.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is.
Forget it. They should just public all the tax returns. Let the public vote on who gets audited. Turn it into a goddamn game show.
Well, why not? I mean, you know, this completely irrational focus on Trump's tax returns. I mean, you know, we've talked about this, but for the life of me, I can't understand what Trump's tax returns have to do with anything.
No. But how do you think about what's going on today with coronavirus as another emergency that demands great revenues?
Well, you know, I think it's very, very clear that, you know, governments have really ratcheted up spending. You know, they've been giving out money left, right, and center. They've closed down businesses. I mean, I'm speaking largely from a Canadian perspective, okay? They've closed down businesses, which are then going to require support. You know, they're injecting so much money into the economy, okay, that number one, you know, there has to be massive inflation, which is a tax, of course. There has to be massive inflation. But also, you know, there's no question they're going to be having to raise taxes, you know, to try to absorb some of these ongoing extra costs. And the question is, how are they going to do that? And, you know, I've seen in the Canadian media, for example, all kinds of discussion of, well, isn't it time to have a wealth tax? Or in Canada, you sell your house to tax-free cap, your principal residence to tax-free capital gain. Isn't it time to start taxing, you know, capital gains, et cetera? So, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, I don't think that one could make the case, well, neither you nor I were there, but I would doubt that the amount of spending in relation to this is on a par with what, say, World War II cost or something like that. I would doubt it, okay, very much. But what it is a sort of unexpected event where all of a sudden, you know, a massively larger amount of money, you know, had to be focused in a different direction. So, you know, there is no doubt that, you know, this is going to cause a major adjustment in taxation, a major adjustment in the way people live, you know, et cetera. So, I mean, you know, you tell me, what do you think governments are going to do to, I mean, first of all, would you agree that they're likely to seize on the coronavirus thing as a government knows better, this is an emergency to get taxes up in the same way that this is a war tax we've got to pull together?
Oh, I don't think that they will do it. I think they are doing it, right? I think everything that we see indicates that is exactly what they're doing. I mean, they're using this as a prime opportunity to seize power. What I think is really, it's maybe not a fair comparison, but when you compare a government to a business, right? I mean, I've owned several businesses throughout my lifetime, and whenever there's a crisis or something happens, sometimes you have to shift resources within the business, right? You have to cut back on certain expenses to be able to spend more in other areas. And I think that one of the things that's very irresponsible of governments today is they are demanding more taxes, and they're going to keep demanding more taxes from their citizens, but they are not cutting spending on any level, right? They've just taken everything they were already doing and adding to it. And it seems to me that in order to really, assuming that all the spending was the right answer, but it does need to be paid for, right? I mean, one, the citizens need to contribute their share, but it needs to be fair and equitable. It can't be discriminatory. But governments also need to par back on other expenses to help be able to meet these new financial burdens.
Okay. So, I mean, we agree that governments need to be more prudent, cut back on expenses, but let's explore the idea of what would be, to use the language of Charles Adams, the equitable principles of taxation to finance this? I mean, you know, maybe we can start with what they would not be. Why don't we start with that? What would be an example of something that's clearly not an equitable principle?
Well, not the billionaire tax, right? I think that something that's equitable is something that fairly and evenly applies to the citizen, right? I mean, if a government came in and said, listen, we're going to charge a 10% wealth tax on every citizen, I would argue that it's excessive, but it is fair and equitable in its application, right? It applies
fair to the application. Okay. All right. I mean, that certainly makes sense to me. Now let me ask you this. I mean, you know, like it's so obviously, you know, it makes such obvious sense, right? That if you're going to have a tax, you apply it to everybody. Why do they not apply these taxes to everybody?
Because everybody will revolt.
I see. So in other words, it would be like a divide and conquer sort of principle. What we'll do is if we have 100 people, we're going to tell 93 of them, because it was, you know, 93 of them that you're safe. We're only going to go after you seven. The seven can't really object, and the 93 right. No longer have a reason to object, right?
Exactly. Very good analogy.
Well, you know, on that note, interestingly, you know, as you know, there's this ongoing controversy about citizenship taxation. And yesterday I learned that Congressman Beyer B-E-Y-E-R, I don't know how to pronounce his name, no disrespect intended. In any case, had introduced a bill which essentially enhances the foreign earned income exclusion so that for a majority of Americans abroad, there would be relief, but it appears to have specifically left out small business entrepreneurs for which there is no relief. Does that sound fair and equitable to you?
Oh, absolutely not. And I mean, I think when you look at a lot of I think that probably the self-employed expats are the largest growing population of expats, right? I mean, everybody's a digital nomad today. And so that's a huge segment, or at least a growing segment of the expat population.
Well, it, you know, to me, you know, I mean, who knows for sure what, if anything, they were thinking? Probably not much, because again, it's a bunch of patchwork legislation, right? Let's not rethink it from, you know, let's just do something. Yeah. But it seems to me to be, you know, the one principle, when I look at Americans abroad and possible tax reform, it seems to be consistent, is that the approach is always divide and conquer, right?
Always.
Let's quell some of the discontent by, you know, letting a majority out and leave the ones that we're going to continue persecuting to fight for themselves, right? You know, they'll lose their supporters. And, you know, we see this just time and time again. And, you know, so we go back to, you know, Charles Adams, and we look at the sentence, okay, taxed according to what they're worth by equitable principles, not odious arbitrariness, right? Do you think that the divide and conquer, not only is it not equitable, but it would seem to be fairly arbitrary? Well, you know, we're just going to let this work out.
For sure.
You know, and we see this like right across the board. You know, when I look at the U.S. tax system today, I mean, these are my thoughts, and, you know, I'd be interested in yours. But, you know, you say, well, what is the U.S. tax system? And, you know, I think that the U.S. has 4, 5, 6 different tax systems, right? I mean, they have a tax system for Americans abroad that's more punitive than for resident Americans. They have a tax system for undocumented aliens. Okay, you have to pay these taxes even though they can't benefit from them. They have a tax system for the employee, you know, the high school teacher, something like that. They have a tax system for the self-employed. They have a tax system for carried interest. They have a tax system for billionaires. Well, I mean, holy, I mean, this is incredible, isn't it?
And don't forget, you also have a tax system for drug dealers, right? Because you still have to pay taxes on your profits, even if they're derived from illegal activity.
And a tax system for illegal income. That's exactly right. So, you know, we have this symbol of America, you know, the goddess of justice is blind, right? And, you know, that seems to me to be a bit of a fraud, because when it comes to taxes, you know, you take off the blindfold, looks to me more like the goddess of justice is kind of there winking at people, right? Tell me who you are, I'll tell you what to do.
With her fingers crossed behind her back.
Exactly, exactly. You know, and it seems to me that just on that level alone, I mean, whether we're talking about wars or other great emergencies, you know, I mean, can you really have equitable principles when you have, I mean, what does this mean? Is it like a separate but equal doctrine? You know, that we have equality within each group?
Yeah.
You know, well, all employed people are taxed the same. Well, unless it's Tuesday afternoon and you have to be an American abroad, right?
Well, I think very simply said, it's the same but different.
The same but different, exactly. You know, did you watch Star Trek growing up?
I've seen some episodes, but I was never really into it.
Okay, well, so the original one with William Shatner, okay? There's this, I think everybody listening to this podcast or every U.S. citizen abroad should look for this this particular session, okay, where he's talking about a card game called Fizbin.
Okay.
And basically, you know, it has a bunch of complicated rules where, well, you play this card generally, unless it's Tuesday afternoon, in which, you know, you're going to play this other card. Okay. Unless you have two of this card, in which case it's something else. And I thought, oh my God, that's exactly what the U.S. tax system is about.
Exactly what it's about.
So it's called Fizbin. F-I-Z-Z-B-I-N, Fizbin. Look it up.
Start to look that up.
Fizbin on YouTube, and it's all you need to know about the U.S. tax system.
I'll
those who
that.
Read the internal code, you can stop now. Just watch Star Trek. That's all you need.
All right.
Here we go. Where no system of unfairness has ever gone before.
You got that right.
All right. You know, interestingly, and I thank you for sending this to me this morning, you know, this article about EU countries apparently considering the notion of citizenship-based taxation.
Well, I mean, I think that you know, governments are look at their citizens like property, right? I mean, citizenship-based taxation, in my view, is almost the equivalent of a poll tax, right? It's like, if you're alive, you got to pay.
Now, let's just pause there for a minute. I mean, that's a very, very interesting point you make. I mean, we touched on poll taxes last week as a form of direct tax, right? Which is actually presumptively prohibited by the Constitution. But, you know, this is a really interesting concept. Is a tax on citizenship really a disguised poll tax?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, in my view, I think it arguably is, right? I mean, it's essentially like, hey, you're alive, you need to pay taxes because you're a person, right?
Well, I think that's exactly right. Look in the mirror. Oh, you were able to look in the mirror. Must mean you're alive. You owe us.
Exactly. You'd think the great nation of the United States is who birthed you rather than your mother, right? Like,
I wonder if arguably that isn't true, because the 14th Amendment does say everybody born in the United States is a U.S. citizen, So they may not have birthed you, but they certainly birthed your citizenship.
Yep. And you have to wonder, you know, I think that's wound up being unfortunate for many people.
Well, if you live in the United States, you know, it's not generally a big problem.
However, that's fair.
However, on that note, did you see this decision that came down a week or so ago? I've seen some blog posts talk about this, where this man had been assessed, I think, a $40 million FBAR penalty or something, and he was a U.S. citizen who was living outside the United States, and he was sued in the United States by the government with a view to forcing him to repatriate those funds. And so you wonder, right, I mean, where did they get the jurisdiction over this guy? Is it because he was a U.S. citizen?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, my understanding, and this, you know, might be wrong, but my understanding is if you're a U.S. citizen and you're living abroad, right, I mean, they can essentially flag your passport and pretty much any country will just grab you and turn you over to the U.S.
If there's an extradition treaty, that's right. And
which most of them have, right? And I mean, I've even...
Or actually, you know what? Let me take that back. I'm not even sure you do need an extradition treaty for that. I don't know. Certainly with an extradition treaty, that would start it. But without it, how does this Interpol stuff work? These international requests? I don't know. Do you?
That's what I'm saying. I think there's some international agreements that would allow... their arrest. And additionally, I mean, look, most countries, extradition treaty or not, are not going to put up a fight against the U.S., right? Like, they don't want their arms cut off or, you know, whatever other sort of financial or military benefits they receive by being friendly with the U.S., visa waiver programs and all that stuff, you know, they'll wind up turning the U.S. citizen over. I mean, almost always.
Well, or what if they're not a U.S. citizen? Would they still turn him over?
If he's not a U.S. citizen?
Yeah.
Well, I think so, right? I mean, I'm aware of some cases. Now, they're not tax cases, but criminal cases where citizens of countries that actually have laws that say we don't extradite our citizens have extradited their citizens in the United States.
That's incredible. Well, they wouldn't call it extradition. They'd call it a friendly package drop-off.
They call it something.
That's incredible stuff. Incredible stuff. You know, as you're well aware, there's a growing market in investment migration, right? You know, for second citizenships and stuff like that. And you know, I see all these articles out there about, you know, what's a good program and, you know, where should you get second citizenship and that sort of thing. And you know, it strikes me that something that's worth looking at is the network of treaties that country has with other countries, right, including the United States.
Yeah, you know, I've never really given that any thought, but I think you're absolutely right.
You know, I mean, tax treaties, extradition, I mean, you know, I mean, a tax treaty is bad enough. It includes exchange of information, right? But, you know, this whole extradition treaty thing is a gigantic problem, as has been, you know, demonstrated. This is something I'm very interested in. No, and I don't know whether you're interested or aware of any of this type of stuff or not. But, you know, we look at, for example, the Ming Wan Zhao thing in Canada, where basically Canada sees this Chinese citizen, you know, and kept her, didn't allow her to leave the country for a few years because of a U.S. extradition request over something that was not done in Canada, was not done in the United States, you know, et cetera. And, you know, I think that was a terrible abuse of an extradition treaty, personally. I don't think that's what, you know, they're really intended for. But this is a problem, right?
I think when you look at how close Canada and the United States are, I think the Canadian and the U.S. tax treaty is the only tax treaty that I'm aware of where you guys collect each other's taxes.
Well, there's a few more, aren't very many. There's like five or six of them or something.
Yeah.
But the way the treaties are written, what's interesting is they won't collect taxes if the tax debtor was a citizen of the other country. So, for example, if you have a Canadian citizen living in Canada and there's a U.S. tax debt, what the treaty says is that the Canada Revenue Agency won't help the IRS on that tax debt if the person was a Canadian citizen. But that's, of course,
what if they're a dual citizen?
Sorry?
What if they're a dual citizen?
Oh, same thing. Yeah, the test is whether you're Canadian and vice versa.
All right.
There are other countries, Netherlands. I don't have a list. I mean, there's five or six of these, but the reason that I have the Netherlands at the tip of my tongue, so to speak, is because, you know, there have actually been some court skirmishes recently about the, in relation to the whole FATCA IGA stuff there, right? Whether Dutch accidental American Dutch citizens should have to comply with this. And, you know, I've often thought that an argument that might be made is that, you know, pursuant to the treaty, the IRS couldn't collect on somebody who's a Dutch citizen anyway. So, you know, shouldn't dual citizens or citizens of the Netherlands be exempt from this sort of thing? I don't know the answer to that, but I mean, the IGAs were a byproduct of the tax treaties, right? The same tax treaties, you know, that have this provision. So I really don't know, but you know, I think that's an interesting question. So, you know, back to this question of things that are perhaps not equitable or are equitable. Now, those who would say, I'm pretty sure that, you know, those who would say, well, you know, so you say, you know, leaving aside whether wealth tax, good tax or bad tax, is at least equitable if it applies to everybody, right?
I would say so.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I think that's entirely rational. So, you know, those who, you know, whose DNA would be different would say, well, but that's regressive. It's regressive on, you know, people who only have enough assets, you know, to sort of make ends meet, et cetera. How do you respond to that? Right. I mean, they would say, well, you know,
everybody has to pay their fair share. I mean, listen, everybody, I think it's fair that everybody has to pay their fair share, right? If you live in a country and you're benefiting from its services, and even if you're not, even if you don't like those services, if you're living there and you're a resident, you got to pay for it. But it needs to be everybody. I think it's fundamentally unfair that somebody is required to pay for somebody else simply because they have more money. It is not the job of wealthy people to take care of anybody else.
Okay. All right. I mean, obviously, you know, you're preaching the converted on that, but, you know, why is it that, you know, I think a clear critical mass majority of thinking in the whole world of tax policy fundamentally disagrees with that?
Well, because it's easy to get the support of people by promising them free shit that they don't have to pay for.
In other words, more people are voting for a living than working for a living.
Of course. I mean, I think, look, if you look at the, and I mean, this isn't just in the United States, this is in most, you know, to call them Western democracies. This is how the politicians get things passed and how they get elected, right? They say, listen, we're going to give you, it's essentially bribery, right? We're going to give you this additional services. We're going to provide this. We're going to provide that. Oh, and this guy's going to pay for it. And so, of course, the people go, oh, yeah, that sounds fantastic. We're going to get free stuff that somebody else is going to pay for. That's easy to pass, right? Because they've actually done studies that say, if they were going to, that those people would not vote the same way if they had to pay more, right? Even if it was a very small percentage. And this, I think, is why this equality is so important. Because even if your net worth is $100, if you got to give 10 of that, 10%, you're really going to think about, do I need these additional services or do I need my $10 more, right? And I think that that's very, very important. And if people don't have any skin in the game, then they don't care. They're just going to take.
Yeah. All right. Now, let's look specifically at this whole, you know, these clearly escalating coronavirus-related expenses. And I want to touch on a couple of things here, right? We talk about, you know, taxation in relation to services. Now, you know, the United States, you know, whether you agree or disagree with this, I mean, as a matter of simple fact, has spent a lot of money and made a huge, huge investment in trying to vaccinate what Joe Biden called all Americans, but in practice has just been Americans resident in the United States. The State Department has flatly refused to provide vaccines to Americans abroad. Do you think that that bears in any way, shape, or form on the propriety of imposing worldwide taxation on Americans abroad?
I think absolutely. I think if you're an American anywhere, if you're paying into the tax system like everybody else, then you need to get the same services. You need to be entitled to the same things, which would include vaccination.
Would that be an example of what Charles Adams might call odious arbitrariness?
I believe absolutely, right? Because you're essentially being treated as a different class of American simply by where you live, even though, you know, you're still paying in. And I mean, I think the vaccination is just one of many services that Americans abroad, you know, pay for and don't get.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, somebody sent me a message a couple of weeks ago. I mean, this is not huge, but it is interesting that, you know, apparently people in the United States who buy a certain kind of car get a tax credit. But if you're living outside the United States, you don't get that same credit.
Yep.
You know, and again, you know, that seems to me to be, you know, it seems to me to be discriminatory. It's what, say, somebody like Laura Snyder, she coined the term placism. You know, which I think makes a lot of sense. Now, here's another interesting one. You know, the use of the tax system in, you know, times of great emergency. You know, I was reading. Now, I don't know anything about how the healthcare system works in Singapore. Okay, and it may be different from, you know, publicly. Well, let's just imagine, okay, a public healthcare system, and let's imagine a decision to say, well, yeah, of course we have public health for all our residents, unless you refuse to be vaccinated for the coronavirus, in which case you do not get that. What would be your thoughts on that? I mean, is tax policy an appropriate way to pressure people to get vaccinated?
I don't believe it's an appropriate way, but I think that you know, you can probably, I mean, you could definitely foresee that happening.
Well, not only that, but what's interesting, you know, as I look back over, my God, it's a year and a half or something, as an observer of this, and, you know, and I've got to say that I have not personally been inconvenienced by this a great deal, okay? But, you know, looking around, I mean, if you had small kids and that, right, and you were having to live in an apartment with small kids, I mean, can you imagine, you know, what people like that must be going through, you know, with the school.
I had a buddy of mine here in Dubai during, you know, we had like a 40-day, we had a lockdown, you know, for quite some time. And even once the lockdown lifted, the offices were supposed to, you know, were relatively remaining closed. And he had a wife and two small kids, and he was sneaking to the office, you know.
I can imagine, but it's interesting how, you know, I don't think this is directly related to taxation, but I think it's a way that taxation could expand, is how the use of these things has actually managed to divide groups in society, you know, offering benefits to one group, but not another. Near where I live, there's a church who for the last few years has run sort of public sessions on something to do with, you know, the prison systems. And, you know, essentially the theme has been the high level of the unreasonable incarceration of certain types of individuals, you know, who don't pose a threat to society. But, you know, some of these quarantine rules and vaccine rules seem to me to come very, very close to creating a certain form of incarceration. You know, you have to stay in, or you can't go here, you can't go there, you know, these vaccines. Now, I'm not debating the policy particularly, but I think it's worth observing that, you know, these kinds of regulations and you know, and tax policy could easily expand into this, right? For example, get a vaccine or something, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that this is actually a real possible danger here. You know, and why does this relate to what we're doing? Well, great emergencies demand great revenues, right? All citizens should be taxed according to what they're worth, you know, equitable principles, et cetera. And, you know, I could imagine, and I've seen, you know, snippets of suggestions of this type of stuff, right, to put tax penalties on, you know, people who don't conform, you know, with various rules, right? And we see this, you know, on a level that nobody would even think about. I mean, doesn't the U.S. disallow foreign tax credits if the tax is paid in certain countries?
Yeah, if you're doing business in a boycotting country, so if you're doing business in a country that boycotts Israel, then your tax credits are disallowed.
Right. So, you know, that strikes me again as very unjust. I think very unfair. Would you agree?
No, I would absolutely agree. I mean, look, I think tax is definitely used as a tool to enforce policy, which is, you know, not just in my opinion, but it's certainly used that way.
And I think that we're going to see a lot of this coming through, you know, out of the woodwork in relation to this COVID-19 thing stuff. I really do.
No, I agree with you.
So what would be, let's talk about sales taxes here for a second, okay? I'm interested in your thoughts on, you know, so, you know, your view would be that if we have a wealth tax, it should be applied right across the board. Sales taxes, a value-added tax, a 20% VAT, should that be applied right across the board?
Yeah, if it's applied across the board, yeah.
So what would be an example then? Is there such a thing as a regressive tax?
I mean, I don't think that there is, I don't think that any sort of progressive tax really is equitable or fair, right? It needs to apply across the board.
Well, so the failure in this regard is really just political expediency and the attempt to get bad, you know, fundamentally unfair legislation passed into law without objection.
Again, of course.
You know, it's this divide and conquer principle, you know, which we're honestly seeing as I look at the, you know, the attempts. And by the way, I obviously applaud and support the attempts. So this is not, you know, dumping on anybody in particular. But the reality is that these attempts to get tax relief for Americans abroad are always using the divide and conquer principle. For example, well, you know, if you're an employee with an income less than $400,000, you should be exempt, but everybody else should not be exempt. I mean, you know, these things sort of create good Americans, those who have 9-to-5 jobs, and bad Americans, those who run businesses. I mean, you know, this is absurd. It's ridiculous. I mean, the whole point should be just to rethink the notion of citizenship taxation and not to provide carve-outs for people some of the time.
Well, I mean, look, obviously, I agree with you. But that's not in the government's interest, right? I mean, what's in the government's interest is that everybody is basically an employee for giant corporations, because that way the income is very easily tracked and very difficult to manipulate with business expenses and things like that. And so, I mean, I think...
I want to link that directly back to a conversation we previously had about the Biden's introduction of the bank reporting requirements, right? Yeah. You know, and how they then tried to provide exemption for people who are, what is that, a W-2 or something, who are employees of W-2, going after, you know, the small business, self-employed type of person, right? And it's exactly the same principle again. So sorry, continue.
No, but I mean, when you look at I mean, society, you know, sort of, let's call it the economic society as a whole, you know, they really sort of stack the system in favor of a W-2 employee, right? I mean, there's not only exemptions for this reporting, now there's this exemptions, you know, they're talking about for Americans abroad, but, you know, if you want to open a bank account, if you want to get a mortgage, if you want to get insurance for something, they make it all easier if you're a W-2 employee because it's so easily tracked. And if you are any type of self-employed person or an investor who lives off of investments, and you have to try to you know, kind of get mortgages or do these things, it's very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting. Well, I think we've talked enough today. I don't want to get this podcast too
long. Right.
It's amazing how, you know, as I go through these discussions with you, these are fascinating discussions. You bring great insight, and I thank you for these discussions. But it's
interesting. I'm really enjoying it.
You know, so Charles Adams is writing through the lens of history, right? And every time we're just talking about the principles sort of the modern world. And you know, it reminds me of, who was it that said that those who don't learn the lessons of history are bound to repeat them? You know, we're seeing this just time and time again.
We're right in the middle of it. I mean, you could just read Charles Adams's book, For Good and Evil, and you'll know exactly how this ends.
Absolutely. Well, it's a great book. And of course, we recommend it to everybody, and we invite you to continue tuning in with us on Mondays where we discuss this. So this has been great, Jimmy. And how would people get a hold of you if they want? They
can check us out at esquiregroup.com or shoot us an email at info@esquiregroup.com.
All right. Well, that's fantastic. And I look forward to next week. Thank you.
Thank you.